believe. Probable cause to believe is a quantum of proof that is a condition precedent to an officer being able to present to a person they have stopped a PBT in order to ask them to provide a sample of their breath. It is the county's position that probable cause to believe should be interpreted by this court as a quantum of proof less than probable cause to arrest. Probable cause to believe in the context of this statute means that the officer has cause to believe the PBT is likely to produce evidence that the person is or has been violating the operating while under the influence statute. Nowhere in section 343.303 does the phrase probable cause to arrest appear. And it is not a radical or novel concept for this court to determine what probable cause means in a particular context. Probable cause is not a one-size-fits-all term in the law. The term or phrase, probable cause to believe, not only is found in 343.303, but is also found in 968.04. That is the statute that relates to the issuance of a complaint on a warrant or summons. There, the language is that a judge shall issue a warrant or summons in lieu thereof when there is probable cause to believe that an offense has been committed and that the defendant committed it. Section 970.03 is the preliminary examination statute. That statute says that a preliminary examination is a hearing for the purpose of determining if there is probable cause to believe a felony has been committed by the defendant. First, in State versus Knobloch in 1969, this Supreme Court interpreted that the probable cause to believe at the complaint stage is a quantum of proof less than the probable cause to believe found at the stage for bindover. This court, in an opinion just authored by the Chief Justice, in fact ruled in TRB and expanded on that initial Knobloch concept and said that probable cause is a matter of degree, and that the probable cause at the complaint stage is a lesser degree than the probable cause at the stage of bindover. And this court said it is a matter of the function of what probable cause is to accomplish. At the stage of the criminal complaint, the court noted in TRB that the function of probable cause is to determine whether the government should be allowed to conduct further inquiry into the alleged criminal behavior, and that the function of the preliminary examination is to decide whether or not a defendant should be held for trial after a bindover, and that both of those levels of proof are less than at trial, which in a criminal case is beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, now to arrest. The first arrest was under 346.63.
Yes.
Now to arrest under 346.63, you have to have probable cause, right?
Yes, Justice.
Tell me what the probable cause is. So there is probable cause to believe, right?
Yes.
That
the individual is or has violated Section 346.63 sub 1 sub A, the operating under the influence statute.
Okay. Now, that take it back to 343.303, which is the section we're talking about.
Yes.
There it says, if a law enforcement officer has probable cause to believe that the person is violating or has violated
346.631,
right?
Yes.
Now I'm going to go back. You told me that to arrest under 346.631 is probable cause to believe that the individual is or has violated 346.63. So the way I read it, and I agree with you, your statement, both under 343.303, and that is to request the PBT, right? Make the request for this preliminary screening test.
Right.
You have to have probable cause believe that you're violating or violated 346.63. And the language under 346.63 to make an arrest is to have probable cause to believe that you violated 346.63. So it seemed to me that you've got the same standard in two statutes, 343.303 and 346.63, and therefore the probable cause should be the same definition.
That's where the ambiguity arises, Chief Justice.
Well, but, and your position is you need less for 343 than you need for 346.
That's correct.
But I'm saying you will use the same language. Why hasn't you reached the result if you want?
Because if all you did was end the analysis there, and that's what the Court of Appeals did. When you end the analysis there, it is game over. Shut your books. I go home. It's very simple. But the rules of statutory construction say you have to look at the rest of this statute.
Absolutely, and you're relying on what? Second sentence, right?
Second and third sentence.
Okay, let's go through that.
I'll start with the third first, if that's all right.
Fine.
In that third sentence, it reads, the result of the preliminary breath screening test shall not be admissible in any action or proceeding except to show probable cause for an arrest if arrest is challenged. For that section to have meaning, you have to be able to have the trial judge consider the result of the PBT to say probable cause to believe means probable cause to arrest. Writes out of that statute that sentence. And let me give this point to illustrate, because I think it makes it crystal clear. Defendant Renz drinks, becomes intoxicated, drives his vehicle. He's stopped by Deputy Drena. Deputy Drena runs him through the field sobriety test. He's arrested. He's taken for a blood test, and the blood test results come in. He's prosecuted. Mr. Mays, on behalf of Mr. Renz, brings a motion to suppress, saying the officer did not have probable cause to arrest my client, and therefore everything after the point of arrest should be suppressed. At that suppression hearing, a hearing to determine, that is the hearing in which the arrest is challenged, a hearing to determine whether there's probable cause. The officer I put on the stand, I run through the field sobriety test. I get to the point of saying, and did you give a PBT to the defendant? There's an objection from Mr. Mays. He says, Your Honor, before the state can ask that question, you, under Renz, must decide whether the officer had probable cause to arrest. The judge says, under Renz, that's true. That's what I have to do as it exists right now. And as the defense purports, so the court, trial court goes through the analysis at the suppression hearing, adds up all that evidence, and then says, I find that there is not probable cause to arrest at this juncture. Your objection is sustained. I am not allowed to ask the officer what was the result of the PBT. That application completely writes out that third sentence, because the state then is not allowed, the county is not allowed, to put in the result to do what the statute clearly says we have the right to do, to admit the result in an action in which the arrest is challenged, to show probable cause. That means the PBT should be allowed to support the officer's probable cause and to allow the county, the prosecution, and to allow the trial court to consider, in deciding whether there was probable cause to arrest, the PBT result.
Well, in your hypothetical, it sounds all right, but maybe the objection is raised and the judge is overruled. Pursuant to 343.303 sub 3, it can come in to show whether or not there's probable cause for arrest, and I'm not going to grant the objection.
And the defendant then appeals the court's ruling and says the court has erred because they ignored the clear ruling of the Court of Appeals in Renz, which said you have to have probable cause for arrest in order to ask that question.
Let's look at the Court of Appeals decision. I mean, as I read it, and maybe there are obviously different ways to read it. The Court of Appeals decision says, look, in response to this exact argument, is it circuitous? And they say essentially, we know that our holding, we admit that our holding limits the applicability, if I at all mischaracterize it correctly, would you please, limits the applicability of the use of PBTs. But it doesn't erase all use of PBTs. And that's what I, and then it continues to go on, and what I recall is this. And I think of the Sharpie case, where in the Sharpie case, you had, everyone said before the administration of PBT, there was sufficient evidence for probable cause for arrest. And as I recall the issue in that case, it was what, and then they gave PBT, and lo and behold, it just wasn't very good from a prosecutorial point of view. And the issue was whether or not, even though they had probable cause to arrest, can this real bad PBT, for prosecutorial purposes, per se negate, I think was the question, probable cause. And the court said, no, you had the probable cause, you give the PBT, just because it's bad doesn't per se negate it. And there still can be a finding of probable cause. I understand the Court of Appeals in this case to be saying, look, you need probable cause for arrest in order to give a PBT. PBT, like Sharpie, can be bad for prosecutorial purposes. It doesn't per se negate it, but it may mitigate whether or not the officer is actually going to arrest. Or it may be good for prosecutorial purposes in that it has a high showing, and boy, it's going to be a real solidifier of any probable cause then. That's how I interpret the Court of Appeals' opinion when it says it limits the applicability of the PBT but doesn't erase all use of it. Now, you may disagree with the Court of Appeals' opinion, but do you agree with my interpretation of what they're saying?
There's a distinction to be made. They cited the two things. One is that their decision would undercut the use of the PBT. That is a reference not to the third sentence, but to the second sentence of the statute, which indicates the result of this preliminary breath screening test may be used by the law enforcement officer for the purpose of deciding whether or not the person shall be arrested. And what the Court of Appeals said is, we recognize it will limit or diminish the opportunities for the use of the PBT. And stated another way, I think that was a euphemistic way for saying, we recognize it will rarely be used by cops, because cops are very practical, pragmatic people. And when they know that the law tells them they have to have probable cause to arrest before they can get their PBT out, They aren't going to bother to get their PBT out. That's what the Court of Appeals is talking about when it's talking about undercutting or diminishing. When they make the reference to the circularity of their ruling, what they were doing was recognizing the fact that you will be left chasing your tail. And they didn't address in any way that third sentence in their decision. They didn't touch it. And they couldn't afford to touch it because it would create that kind of inconsistency, which is you have to have probable cause to be able to give the PBT, but in the third sentence, you get to use the PBT to determine whether there's probable cause. But you can't put the probable, you know, and you go around and around. And what they recognized is that the circularity of their ruling, what they should have more accurately said is, as to the third sentence, we are writing that out. Because the evidentiary foundation doesn't allow you to get the result in. You don't get Sharpie because you have to have probable cause to arrest before you can admit it. And if the court says, for instance, let's look at the converse. I asked the question, did you use the PBT? There's the objection in the court rules. I find that as a matter of fact, based on the evidence produced by this officer and their observations and testimony and experience, and as a matter of law, applying probable cause to arrest standards, now we're talking about applying Wrens as the Court of Appeals set it out, that you have shown that the officer had probable cause to arrest. In that situation, there is going to be no purpose served by then saying, continue, Mr. Wambach, ask him what the PBT result is. Because the court will have already ruled that there was probable cause to arrest. There's no purpose in having any further analysis then. There's no purpose in putting in the PBT. It won't even be cumulative. It will be worthless. Because the court had to make a factual and legal determination.
In other words, the first question would be at the suppression hearing, did you have probable cause to take the PBT?
Yes.
If the court says yes, then if you take the Court of Appeals view, by definition, the answer as to whether the arrest is valid is yes, too.
One is going to fall right from the other, Chief Justice, exactly.
And you don't need anything else.
You're not going to need anything else, and you're not going to need the third sentence. And rules of statutory construction say, avoid those interpretations, courts, that are going to make any language superfluous.
You know, this is a very, from my perspective, I think this is a tough case as to whether they had a probable cause to arrest.
Prior to the admission of the PBT?
Prior to the admission of the PBT. He was given, what was it, 8 of the usual kinds of tests. I may get the wrong number wrong, but you can tell me the number of tests to see whether or not they thought he was driving under the influence. And on some of them, he came through fairly well. He was able to recite the whole alphabet. It's one of the tests, so he did it for, 10 seconds or 10 whatever it is.
18 seconds.
Yeah. And it's required for about 30, is that it? But then when
yes.
He did it again, he made it up to 20 or something. You know, he tested high on the PBT, right?
0.18.
That's right. For me, that's high.
That would be high for anyone, Your Honor.
I don't mean for me personally.
Right. And I didn't mean it by Chief Justice, right. That you have a high tolerance for alcohol.
You have to watch this tape. This is high, and yet, you know, after I saw that, I was really quite stunned, and clearly that... if that was evidence of the PBT were presented, I would say there was certainly probable cause to hold him, to arrest him for violation of 346.631. So what you have here, I think, at least when I went through this, you know, a really tight case, tough case, I should say here, as to which way you go without this PGT. And I'm wondering whether that isn't what they're after. So my question is, suppose the statute read, any law enforcement officer who makes a lawful stop for violation of the traffic code may request the person to provide a sample of his or her breath for preliminary screening test using a device approved by the department for this purpose. Would that be an okay statute? And we have a valid muffler stop here, right?
Okay. Correct.
So, here I am driving home, I have a bad muffler, I'm stopped, and nothing, I mean, there may be no smell of alcohol, or even if you do have a smell of alcohol, nothing else. Would a statute like that be valid?
I believe it would, Chief Justice. Under the Skinner decision, United States Supreme Court decision, there was the case in which any time there was a train, a derailment or collision or accident, without a drug test to determine whether there was alcohol. And the United States Supreme Court talked about the importance of safety. Our courts have, throughout the history of dealing with these OWI cases, talked about the carnage on the roadway. That's a quote from one of the cases, talking about the compelling state interest. And if the statute were crafted that way, if it were rewritten by the legislature that way, I believe it would pass constitutional muster, yes. But that isn't as far as this court is being asked to go, not by a long stretch, because the county is asking that this court find that there is less than probable cause to arrest, but still a probable cause standard.
Well, counsel, actually, what I hear you saying is that you want us to read into the term probable cause to believe essentially a reasonable suspicion standard.
No, Chief, no, Justice, that I'm not asking that. That would not be proper under the legislative analysis. The legislature considered reasonable suspicion and did not adopt that language. Therefore, it's reasonable to conclude that they rejected that, and that probable cause to believe does not mean reasonable suspicion. What I'm saying is that probable cause is, in fact, a fluid concept that works on a continuum. And as you move along the criminal process, let's say this is a fifth offense, so it's a felony OWI, and the officer never knows when they stop somebody what it's going to be, you would have reasonable suspicion to stop them. You're at the bottom of the hill. That's been satisfied. The next step would be probable cause to believe that they have violated the statute, which is less than probable cause to arrest, and that would allow you to ask them to give a PBT. The next step along the way is probable cause to arrest, which is the same as probable cause in the sufficiency of the complaint. Next step up the level, you're pushing the ball uphill, is probable cause to get a bind over, and finally, beyond a reasonable doubt. And
so you're saying that it's more than a reasonable suspicion.
Yes.
But less than probable cause to arrest for drunken driving.
Correct.
It falls somewhere in between that.
Yes.
How do you deal with the cases, which I have not read?
Knobloch.
The ones actually that are cited in the Court of Appeals opinion, which says, on page 12 of the slip opinion, 112 of the appendix, probable cause in the context of arrest is well defined in case law, is what it says. It refers to that quantum of evidence that would lead a reasonable police officer to believe that a person probably committed a crime. Probable cause to believe is the same, I understand this to mean, as probable cause to arrest. and they cite State versus Pasek, they cite State versus Babbitt for that proposition. I hear your argument to be saying they're the same, that they're different, they're not the same in this fluid scale that starts on from reasonable suspicion and goes to probable cause to arrest, that there's a stopping point in between, which is probable cause to believe. The Court of Appeals, at the page that I've indicated, said that those two things are the same, probable cause to believe and probable cause to arrest. Do we overturn those cases? Do they cite if they're accurately cited?
My time is up. I'd like to answer your question. Okay. Justice, when they said probable cause to arrest was well defined, there was no question about that. But when they said that probable cause to believe had only one quantum in the law, if that's exactly what they meant, and I don't believe that's what they meant, I think they were being much more finite. I think they were simply saying, since we have concluded it's got to be probable cause to arrest, and based on their statutory interpretation analysis. And since probable cause to arrest was well defined, then the analysis ends there, and everyone knows what that means. But they overlooked, in my estimation, the fact that probable cause to believe is found in the two statutes that I cited to this court at the beginning of my comments. And it's that, and clearly, in Knobloch and again in TRB, it was recognized by the parties and by the courts analyzing those terms that they are two different things, that at the complaint stage it's less than at the prelim stage. There isn't any way around those cases, and certainly we don't want to, in order to make sense of this statute, overrule precedent that has been here since 1969, saying that probable cause to believe is different and higher at the bindover stage than it is at the stage of arrest. In order to harmonize this statute, it is most logical and sensible to say that probable cause to believe, given the way the legislature set out the language in the second and third sentences, must mean less than probable cause to arrest, but still probable cause. And when you think about the function of asking someone to take a PBT, the intrusion is very low, and the intrusion is less than actually putting them under arrest. Because as you pointed out, for instance, your PBT result may be such that it's going to be low enough that the officer may decide not to arrest that person. And so its function is lower, and it makes sense that as a probable cause quantum of proof, it also be lower, because the privacy interests, the liberty interests, are less asking someone to take a PBT than they are at the time you arrest them, than they are at the time you arraign them, or at the time you bring them to trial. It is the best way to harmonize the ambiguity within the statute and to make sense of the whole. And that's what I ask this court to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wombeck. Mr. Mays, you represent Christopher Wren.
May it please the court, my name is Stephen Mays, and I represent the respondent in this matter, Mr. Christopher Renz. The issue raised by the petitioner in this case is whether the legislature really meant what it said when drafting Wisconsin Statute 343.303. The Court of Appeals obviously thought they did in their unanimous decision, concluding that probable cause within that statute means probable cause to arrest. In reaching the conclusion, the Court of Appeals looked at the legislative history and intent behind the creation of that statute. While the unanimous Court of Appeals did hold that a statute is ambiguous when it is capable of being understood in two or more different senses by reasonably well-informed persons, a statute is not rendered ambiguous merely because parties disagree as to its meaning. Now, in Virgil versus State, this court stated that in looking at statutory language, courts must arrive at the intent of the legislature by giving language its ordinary and acceptable meaning. And within that said, you can look at dictionary meanings, you can look at case law definitions. Now, probable cause, as it's defined in Black's Law Dictionary, means a requisite element of a valid arrest and something which is required at the time of arrest. Turning to case law, the Court of Appeals did a substantial analysis, as Justice Bradley pointed out, stating that probable cause is well defined in case law. It then defines it, as Justice Bradley did. They concluded it is reasonable to assume the legislature was well aware of this case law definition when it chose the words probable cause to believe. Now, they specifically noted the legislature's reliance on that case law when they stated, as Mr. Wambach began to point out, we first observe that in 343.303, the legislature has chosen a different term to describe the standard for administering a PBT with respect to operators of commercial vehicles, detecting any presence of an intoxicant or having reason to believe the person is violating 346.63(7), which is a stricter statute than sub 1. Sub 7 prohibiting a person from operating the commercial motor vehicle with any alcohol above a .00 in their system. The legislature's choice, the Court of Appeals went on, of reason to believe as a standard to trigger the request for a preliminary breath test with regard to the stricter statute on commercial motor vehicles indicates that the legislature could have, but did not, use a term other than probable cause for regular drivers. Now, the Court of Appeals continued because they wanted to make sure to examine the legislative history, and in doing so noted that during the process that led to the enactment of 343.303, the Senate considered and rejected substituting reason to believe for the probable cause to believe in the first sentence. They also noted that there was a draft in the Legislative Reference Bureau draft of Senate Amendment 125 proposing the language reasonably suspects as the standard, however concluded, the fact that the legislature did not adopt the reason to believe or the reasonably suspects language, but instead adopted the probable cause to believe standard is a persuasive indicator that the legislature intended to adopt the standard as defined in the case law.
Now, I know that the cases make a difference between reasonably suspect and probable cause, but what's the difference between probable cause and reasonable cause? Probable cause to believe the person is violating the law, or probable cause to believe the person is violating the law?
Well, if I can use Your Honor's own language, in the case of Johnson versus State, reasonable grounds, if that's going to be similar to reasonable cause, was held to be synonymous to probable cause.
That's right. That's what I thought. And that's what I remembered it. So the legislative failure to adopt the reasonable cause language doesn't get us very far, is it, does it?
Well, it does.
Okay.
And it does because they specifically rejected it, but kept it in the same statute as it relates to commercial motor vehicle drivers, and in 343.305 dealing with the implied consent law and things like that. I'm not here to claim that this statute is artfully drafted in any sense.
Well, counsel, we have a lot of cases that say that unambiguous language can be rendered ambiguous in its contextual setting. The problem that I have with your case is this. If the first sentence ended that statute, I agree with you. But the first sentence doesn't end that statute. There's two other sentences. And since our primary job is to discern the intent of the legislature when dealing with statutory interpretation, I have a very difficult time believing that the legislature truly meant probable cause to believe an arrest, when in fact, for instance, in sentence 3, they say that you can use this to show a probable cause. How can a district attorney, for instance, use a preliminary breath test to, quote, show probable cause for an arrest, end of quote, if the cops must have probable cause before they can even administer the PBT? I cannot reconcile that third sentence with the first sentence, and I'd like you to try to do so.
Your Honor, I don't know that I can. I also don't know that it's my job, and Your Honor, I also don't know that it's yours, with all due respect.
Oh, our job is to try to reconcile language.
To reconcile, you're right, I'm sorry. Your Honor did say in a very recent case decided this year, City of Sun Prairie versus Davis, drafted by Your Honor, that it makes no difference whether we agree or disagree with the policy choices made by the legislature. It is for the legislature to make such choices, ours not to judge them based upon preference, but on legal principles and constitutional authority. Now, to answer Your Honor's question.
And I would remind you that we also have a lot of cases that say our job is to try to give meaning and effect to every sentence in the statute.
Correct. And in addressing the legal principles and constitutional authority, which is this court's job, according to the opinion that I just mentioned, I need to point out Skinner and County of Milwaukee versus Pregler, because both those cases say these are taking of breath samples are a search. Now, under the position taken by the county, they're asking that it means something other than probable cause because of the interplay of the three sentences. But this court, in applying the law and in applying the constitutional principles, which it must, that being of the Fourth Amendment, this court must find that the legislature did not intend to mean anything other than probable cause to arrest because of the reasons that I've stated with regard to their analysis.
But we can also assume, again based on prior cases, that the legislature was aware of our prior cases interpreting certain language, and therefore we can assume, can we not, that the legislature was aware of Knobloch and its progeny, all of which said there are different standards of probable cause depending upon the contextual setting.
True. My answer to that is that in dealing with the first sentence, and I want to take the court through that since the court brought it up, the county concedes that the first sentence would tend to indicate probable cause to arrest. The second sentence, they urge, supports the proposition, this is from their brief, that the PBT is designed for the purpose of assisting officers in gathering and quantifying probable cause. However, in reading that sentence, and I'll get to the third one, trust me, in reading that sentence, you immediately notice the term may, which is another point Justice Bradley brought up in the Sharpe Court case, which, if time permits, I'll get to that as well. The term may, in the sense that the PBT result may be used, well, it also means it may not be, if we want to define the term may, for the purpose of deciding whether or not the person should be arrested. Now, obviously, it's not required, which is, I think, why Sharpe was decided the way it was, under this statute, because probable cause in Sharpe already existed. They made that holding. They said specifically, the performance of the field sobriety test, this is from Sharpe, coupled with the officer's earlier observations of the defendant's strong odor of intoxicants, slurred speech, bloodshot eyes, and having a what they classified a blank stare, justify the administration of a PBT at that point. So they have, the Court of Appeals in Sharpe has essentially ruled that probable cause to request a PBT is no less a standard. Now, getting to the third, let me stay on the second sentence for a minute. What this court should focus on in the second sentence is the language, quote, the result of this preliminary breath screening test may be used by the law enforcement officer, and this is what I emphasize, for the purpose of deciding whether or not to require or request chemical tests as authorized by 343-305. The chemical test contemplated under 343-305 is one only after arrest. The breath sample contemplated there is the one only after arrest, and that's specified in more ways than I can even begin to tell you in 343-305. This leads to the third sentence, which Your Honor brought up.
That's the tough one.
Which Mr. Wambach suggests makes the whole statute ambiguous. They classify that as, because the test result cannot be admitted for any purpose except to show probable cause for an arrest, the quantum of proof to administer the test must be less. My response to that, and again, I'm not taking any responsibility for how this was drafted. They're talking about burdens of persuasion. They keep mentioning the fact that, well, at a prelim, the amount of probable cause you need is less. Actually, you need to show probable cause to arrest. It's a plausibility standard. And that's why it gets into burdens of persuasion. In 343-305, there are a myriad of challenges and opportunities to challenge an arrest. You can do it at a refusal hearing, where in State versus Willie, the Court of Appeals said it's plausibility as the standard, not credibility. So my response to Your Honor's question ultimately is, they're talking about burdens of persuasion. They're trying to get this fluidity concept to go over one edge and go over one edge and cover the whole table. It's not that simple. Nobody really can put a finger on what probable cause means. It's defined in the case law as this, the quantum of proof necessary to lead a reasonable police officer to believe that someone probably committed an offense. But the confusion that the County of Jefferson may have, that anyone may have on this, doesn't make it ambiguous. It's not rendered ambiguous because parties simply disagree as to its meaning. The third sentence that we're focusing on here is ultimately one half of one of five sentences. And again, it's important to remember that in determining the meaning of a single word or phrase in a sentence, it's necessary to look at the entire section. In determining when interpreting a statute such as 343-303, it's necessary to look at that section and how it interplays with other sections, which is why, again, I bring up 343-305. Now, the myriad of opportunities that I address the court in 343-305, as it pertains to the third sentence, led the court, I'm assuming, Court of Appeals, to say that 343-303 is not deprived of all of its meaning or function if the term probable cause means probable cause to arrest. There are administrative suspension review hearings. There are refusal revocation hearings. Now, as it relates to regular drivers and commercial drivers, I can't give the court the answer of why this is the way it is. But they did find enough difference.
Well, isn't the answer, I mean, I could answer why, I think, if we interpret the statute the way the district attorney wants us to interpret it. Because, again, getting back to the intent of the legislature, which is we have to discern that. What you are saying is that it is the intent of the legislature that a police officer, when confronted with this situation, the smell of intoxicants and the failure to, a little bit more than a reasonable suspicion, but less than probable cause, nevertheless has to say to this fellow, get back in your car and go on your way. Because that is the result of if we hold for you. If we hold for the district attorney, we're saying the intent of the legislature was to say to the police officer, look, if you have less than probable cause but more than a reasonable suspicion, you can then request a preliminary breath test before you actually arrest him. Now, what do you think is the more likely intent of the legislature of those two scenarios?
I frankly don't know what the legislature thought, and maybe that's a cop-out as an answer. The intent of the legislature, from my perspective, Your Honor, is simply that probable cause has and always will mean, and has, going back to history, probable cause to arrest. Now, Again, I mentioned the fact that it's not an artfully drafted statute, but I think the intent of the legislature, based on the history of the term probable cause, has always meant probable cause to arrest. And I think in coming to that conclusion, they utilized that along with the interplay that 343.303 has with other statutes. And the fact that they have specifically said in 343.303, probable cause to arrest for regular drivers, I'm sorry, probable cause to believe for regular drivers, any presence of alcohol and reason to believe in commercial drivers, as well as the fact that the legislative history shows we've rejected this in the past. Somebody presented it, we'd be here probably 15 years ago if they would have just adopted that. But they saw fit not to because they thought that's enough of a problem. So again, it's a cop-out. I can't answer that question. It's not for me to do. It's to present the fact that I think the legislature intended, and here's why.
Could I ask, is probable cause for a bindover and a preliminary examination the same as probable cause for arrest?
Well, certainly the burden of persuasion is less. The plausibility. And again, that's somewhat of a difficult question because I don't think that any case has come right out and said the probable cause you need is this. You have to show it by this. It's just simply that it's whether it's reasonable. But they have gone so far as saying in a preliminary examination for a bindover, you need to find probable cause to arrest based on the plausibility of the officer's story, what he says could have happened. And we find probable cause. I don't find the fluidity problem that Mr. Wambach brings, that it is, in fact, different levels of things. In fact, I think that that's clear, and it doesn't help the problem any as far as discerning the intent of the legislature. Chief Justice Abraham Pennison point in the case I mentioned that reasonable grounds means probable cause. Well, let's take it a step further. What does probable cause mean? This is the case. This is the issue that brings us back to it means, as the legislature said, probable cause to arrest. And we're going through, finally, an opportunity to see why it means probable cause to arrest.
Could I read you a passage from a recent decision of the court? In State versus Dunn, this court examined the quantum of evidence necessary at a preliminary hearing to establish probable cause. court compared different standards of probable cause at different stages of the criminal process, from probable cause to search, to probable cause for arrest, to probable cause for a bindover at a preliminary examination. Is that consistent with what you're saying?
No, it's not. But they say in there, nowhere, I didn't believe I heard, probable cause to believe. They've specifically put in this statute probable cause to believe, and that's what we need to look at, what they meant by saying probable cause to believe. Does that mean reasonable suspicion? Certainly not. That would render this and many other statutes superfluous. What does it mean? Well, historically, and I'm sorry I keep going back to historically, but that's what the Court of Appeals spent most of their time in their unanimous decision doing, saying we find no other meaning but. And the reason we find no other meaning but is because it's been presented to us and it's been rejected. It was presented to us again and it was rejected. Ultimately, the one that was adopted is the one that we have before us, probable cause to believe. Now, again, I think maybe this might be the case where the court has to say, this is what it means. But I don't disagree with Dunn at all, that there are those levels as stated. I think the focus should be upon what was intended at each level that the court mentioned in its statement of levels of probable cause.
Counsel, do you agree with the District Attorney Wambach that this statute could read that an officer who makes a lawful stop may request the person to provide a sample of his or her breath for preliminary screening, that you need no reasonable grounds to believe, reasonable cause, reasonable suspicion, probable cause, or anything else to require a person to take the PBT?
No. A breath sample is a search. If you're going to overturn cases, you're going to overturn some age-old cases that breath samples are searches.
Under the Fourth Amendment.
Correct. And what you're going to allow are searches on less than probable cause, which has never been permitted. Now, if you're going to go that far and say, well, okay, we're going to simply allow us a search like this based upon a stop. As the Court of Appeals mentioned in a footnote, State versus Babbitt, they have said refusal to submit to field sobriety tests, first of all, but in this, as it relates to this, refusal to take that can give an officer probable cause. They're going to bootstrap their request, a refusal, into probable cause, just simply by the request. That's why we have the constitutional protection of the Fourth Amendment. So, no, I don't agree that that is something which ought to be permissible.
Well, okay. If that's your position, then what's the standard constitutionally that the legislature had to put in? The lowest standard, the lowest reasonable suspicion for that, search?
For a search?
Well, for requiring a sample. What I'm asking you is, how would you have drafted this if you represented the state, represented law enforcement, to put in the minimal constitutional requirement needed to get a sample?
If a law enforcement officer has reasonable grounds to believe that. And then continue on with it.
The reasonable ground is different than probable cause.
No, I don't. That's why I drafted it that way.
Because
okay. as you stated in the Williams case, it's synonymous.
So then your position, if I understand it, is that requiring probable cause, reasonable grounds to believe, that there's a violation of 346.631 is required in order to make this a constitutional provision. And that's where I've been pushing it.
I wouldn't prohibit it. The Court of Appeals didn't get to the constitutional issue. I wouldn't foreclose it, no. The statute, it's been shown, has been inartfully drafted. So to say, just like other statutory Fourth Amendment requirements, this is a search, let's give it the same protection. Because otherwise, we're going to wind up with that bootstrapping. Well, I stopped you for this muffler, Mr. Renz. Would you blow into this? I smell some kind of an alcohol on your breath. And he says, no. Okay, or in Mr. Renz's case, blow into this. It's a 0.18. But then I want you to say the alphabet, Mr. Renz. Perfect. I want you to stand on one leg at 18, which the trial court, as a finding of fact, said, that's pretty good. Stepped down, restarted at 10, got to 30. On the finger to nose, he did perfectly. Is it reasonable to say to a police officer, are you then not going to arrest this person based on that first initial search, which resulted in a 0.18? Uh-uh. I submit that the officer is going to be tainted, so I think it needs to be made a constitutional protection. And, Your Honor, if I might, in footnote 22, the Court of Appeals even said, legislature, you may want to advise whether changes are necessary to this statute.
I've been pushing you on this, but isn't there a concept that this is consent?
I didn't raise that in my brief. Mr. Wambach did in his, and... No, it's not an issue of consent, because frankly, it's hardly voluntary. Just as I said, to be admissible, it's got to be a voluntary consent. And it's hardly admissible under the cases like Babbitt that say, well, if you don't do it, automatic finding of probable cause. The other point about that is, in 343.305.2, the implied consent law statute, the breath sample they talk about being contemplated in that implied consent law statute is one subject to an arrest. So, yeah, let's look at that for a second, and then we reach the same conclusion that I think the Court of Appeals did when looking at the legislative intent and history. Well, case law says this. Other things have been put into place, or at least attempted to be put into place and rejected. Well, let's take a look at some other sections. 343.305 is cited three times within 303. And in 343.305, the implied consent law statute, it's a breath sample following an arrest. So I think at the end of the line, if we need something to look at, let's look at that. It can't be an implied consent law, because then everyone is impliedly consenting to searches of everything. It's a slippery slope. The Fourth Amendment's being wiped away.
Could I ask you a question? When the officers began to ask the defendant to perform field tests, what's the authority for that? I mean, the walking in 1 foot. What is the authority for that?
You know, I think it stems from the officer's reasonable suspicion to stop if at that point it becomes if he has probable cause
to
believe. But I don't also think that there's a statute on what you can do after you stop somebody, and a statute on the administration of field sobriety tests. I think it's been said in case law that the detention for purposes of field sobriety tests not only is a continuation based on the stop, but then it's permissible if the law enforcement officer has probable cause to believe. Again, I don't, and I'm sorry, think it gets us anywhere. It's circular. But again, not my fault, not the court's fault, it's the legislature. Now, something I wanted to mention to Justice Babich earlier is that in Ball versus District Number 4, the court stated it is not reasonable to presume that the legislature prefers elegance over precision in its wording of statutes. The more reasonable presumption is that the legislature chooses its terms carefully, precisely, to express its meaning. Now, maybe they blundered this one.
You know, you said it isn't our fault. I'm just wondering, to me, this is a difficult case. And I don't mean this facetiously, but it almost seems like that the reasonable suspicion should be one sniff. You know, seems like it. You know, and then it's something in between is two sniffs. And probable cause to arrest is three sniffs. I don't know what all of this means. I look at some of the other cases
that I've been reviewing, and it is kind of axiomatic in some of these cases to use this kind of language, that the requirement deals with probable cause requirement, or probable cause to arrest or believe or whatever. The requirement deals with probabilities which are not technical, but which are factual and practical considerations of everyday life on which reasonable and prudent persons, not legal technicians, act. You know, and it goes on to say, you know, not fancy labels. I'm not sure what the difference between probable cause to believe is and probable cause to arrest in the argument, and reasonable suspicion, other than the difference between 1, 2, and 3 sniffs.
Well, look at Terry. Terry talks about a reasonable suspicion, and they define that, I think, pretty well. Probable cause is defined throughout case law, which Your Honor brought up with Mr. Wambach, and I defined as well as what a reasonable police officer would believe, or if a reasonable police officer would believe that a crime has been or is being committed.
Given the totality of circumstances, that's what the law says.
Exactly. Now, if you're allowed to stop somebody for a loud muffler, and then you smell alcohol, that's the totality of your circumstances to violate their Fourth Amendment rights by putting a PBT in their face. That's not what I'm suggesting is permissible, which is why I suggest the legislature looked at reasonable suspicion, as Chief Justice Abramson said. Why don't we? Why can't we just do this? I think the statute, if it were up to me, we'd make this a Fourth Amendment issue and not have the statute on it.
You argue that. Chief, may I just follow up with this? I don't know the answer to this, but you talk about the constitutional issue of PBT. Seems to me that maybe implied consent comes into that, like it does the regular breathalyzer. Do you have any response to that?
It's nowhere mentioned in the implied consent law statute 343.303. What is mentioned within 343.303, the PBT statute, is that the result may be used to show probable cause to arrest for the implied consent law statute, which is a requirement that you have probable cause to arrest. If I may, Your Honor, just conclude briefly.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
Very briefly.
Just as the petitioner cannot rewrite the statute to fit its needs, the Court of Appeals in State versus Regal stated, nor may this court rewrite a statute to meet the state's desired construction. The remedy lies with the legislature, not with the courts. The legislature was asked by the Court of Appeals for any changes that might be advisable. The Court of Appeals corrected the legal error, and they are error-correcting courts, committed by the trial court in this case, and I would ask you to so uphold their decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. District Attorney Lomba, you have 5 minutes to rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice. There is the concept of consent involved in 343.303. The defense argued, without elaboration, that it is not consensual for an officer to request a person to take a PBT. Schneckloth versus Bustamante and State versus Douglas, United States Supreme Court and a Wisconsin case, both say that consent is an exception to the warrant requirement, and that consent is an exception to the requirement of probable cause. There is nothing in, first, the facts of this case which would lead this court to conclude that Mr. Renz did not voluntarily, consensually take the PBT. The record is, Deputy Drina testified, I requested, not commanded or demanded or told Mr. Renz he had to take a PBT. I requested he take a PBT, and he took it. As a matter of law, that type of consent in 343.303 is no different than in the context of the automobile search cases, the drug interdiction cases that happen each and every day on our highways that have been approved by this court and the Supreme Court. An officer stops somebody for speeding. Because they have been trained in drug interdiction work, they recognize that there are certain profile factors. And without more, they then ask the person, "Can I search your vehicle?" And the person says, "Yes." And the courts have said that is consensual. And it's outside the ambit of the Fourth Amendment because consent is an exception. And that dovetails back to both the questions from the Chief Justice to Attorney Mays and to myself in asking, could this statute be drafted in such a way, if the legislature wanted to simply say, once you have a proper stop, you can ask someone to voluntarily give a PBT. And you can, and the reason it would be constitutionally permissible as drafted that way is because it would be relying on consent. The last sentence of 343.303 makes it clear that it is consensual by saying the general penalty provision under 939.61.1 does not apply to a refusal to take a preliminary breath screening test. That is so that there is no coercive aspect to the person taking the test because there is going to be no consequence. And I've been a prosecutor for 14 years, and there has never been a case that I have had in which there has been anything but that consent. And there have been many, many police reports and many suppression hearings I've been at in which the officer asked somebody to take a PBT and they declined, and the officer simply accepted that and then was required, based on everything that occurred, including the person's refusal, to decide whether or not they now had probable cause to arrest. But because the officer can consider a refusal to take the test, and because a court could consider that, doesn't, ipso facto, or by its nature, turn what otherwise is consensual into something which is involuntary. Mr. Mays, in his argument, talked about that the part of the third sentence I was arguing to this court about the use at the suppression hearing was one half of one sentence of five sentences. The only import I can take from that argument is to say, as long as it's a small piece of a statute, it's okay to write it out because the rest of it will seem to make sense and fit. That isn't what the case law says this court should do, and that isn't an opportunity this court should seize. You are hearing an SOS coming from 343.303, save our statute. And you have the ability to save this statute. And you should not dodge it. You shouldn't shirk it by saying, fix it, legislature. You need to follow the law, follow your mandate to interpret laws, and to save it if you can. And that is the beauty of the county's position, because it will allow each and every word the legislature wrote into 343.303 to have its full meaning, to not be made superfluous, and to not be contradictory or inconsistent. Thank you,
Mr. Wombat. Thank you, Mr. Mays. That ends our argument on 97.512 and our oral arguments today, and we are in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45.
Post haste. Good.